I'm going to talk a little bit about this paper, Dispersion and Mixing in QG Turbulence by Brocco et al. And the idea is that QG and 2D are really similar in a lot of ways. And in particular, they go into how similar they are in the in their Lagrangian rather than Eulerian properties. But they talk about both. So first of all, the strategy that they use is to do both QG and 2D simulations, and they inject Lagrangian particles into both of them. And see what happens to those particles as the time goes on. And they're both, I'll talk about this more in a little bit, but they're both, the 2D simulation is initialized from the vorticity field at some time in the QG simulation. So, but to start, so let's talk about some of the similarities between QG and 2D. So they share this same advection equation, so the total derivative of vorticity or potential vorticity, and you could write this as the Jacobian or just write it all out, side x. And that's going to be equal to some dissipation operator. So that's the advection equation for both QG and 2D. But they differ in the definitions of the vorticity. So you've got the 2D vorticity plus the, so this is the QG vorticity, 3D. Plus the vortex stretching, so which depends on this. They use S, which is generally a function of Z, but in a minute we'll take it to be constant. So where S is equal to n squared over m squared. And then from here on out, we're going to just call this some constant, but we'll leave it as S, but anyway. And then the 2D vorticity, obviously just this term, so that's gone, but they're advected both in the same way. And also, we're normally you'd have a beta term in here, but they assume the F-plane approximation. Okay, so a few properties about QG and 2D, or similarities between the two, before we get to what they do in the simulations, is that they both conserve energy and entropy. So where these two are defined like this. And the entropy similarly, where alpha could be either 2D or 3D. And so a consequence of the fact that both of these are conserved, both energy and entropy are conserved, is you get a cascade of energy to the large scales. this is your wave number, and this is either entropy, or sorry, energy, or, well, let's write it as energy as a function of k. You get this energy going upscale and entropy going down. Where this is usually the k minus 5/3, and this is the k minus 3. That you can derive starting from those two. And they note some interesting differences in the limits of vanishing viscosity. And maybe I'll just state those rather than writing down, but that the energy is conserved and the entropy is dissipated, which is interestingly different from 3D, which we're not really going to get into here fully 3D, but we're in that same limit. The energy is not conserved. And also, similarly, at viscosity equal to zero in 3D, the entropy is not conserved.
Can I fold in a discussion by
Absolutely.
So this argument that when you have conservation of these two, you have these cascades, that has another assumption in it, doesn't it? It has the assumption that the dissipation is either zero or very small, so that this can, in fact, the whole business of trying to make these cascades is to try to get a computer powerful enough to get one of these cascades to happen.
Right.
So the dissipation is a huge thing. The other thing is, there's this whole idea that somehow the spectrum is going to spread in wave number. I mean, if it just stayed the same as you put it in, none of this stuff would happen. So it's not just a result of conservation of energy and entropy. What's required is that the dissipation be extremely small and there be some mechanism for spreading the perturbations in wave number, in spatial wave number. Well, that's the advection
So
it's not a consequence of energy and entropy. That's a loose statement. It's actually a consequence of the nonlinear advection operator having the property of spreading in wave. That's the primary thing that's going on. But let me ask another question about this idea. Obviously, in the real world, we don't have zero dissipation, finite dissipation. So the authors go out of their way to state that in the case of two-dimensional turbulence, that entropy is dissipated in the limit. And in the case of three-dimensional turbulence, energy is dissipated. That seems to me, I know it's a common statement, but I wonder if anybody could motivate that for me. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me at all. What goes on if you actually start one of these integrations is that this cascade develops, say the k to the minus 3 in the one, it would be the k to the minus 5/3 in the three-dimensional terms. So it starts going down to the lower right, and it keeps going and going and going and going. In fact, in the limit of zero viscosity, it would never dissipate. It would just grow and grow and grow until the age of the universe or the age of 10 universes or whatever you want it. So it seems to me that it's a wrong statement to say that it dissipates. It doesn't dissipate. In the limit of zero viscosity, it never dissipates.
There's a finite time.
There's a double limit involved. Yeah. T goes to infinity and U goes to zero.
Who goes to zero?
Newton.
It dissipated the viscosity.
Depends on, you have to be careful about it.
Okay, explain this. Okay, this is what I want to know. Because it seems to be that in the limit of zero viscosity, and I've seen it in experiments. When I run an experiment, this thing just continues to grow down in time. I don't see dissipation. So motivate for me why it is that this thing doesn't just propagate down but dissipate.
Okay, I mean, that's, I think you're getting at the distinction between the limit of the viscosity goes to zero and viscosity is equal to zero. So you do this, you do the same derivation to get these cascades starting with some arbitrary viscosity, and then you have to take that limit. I mean, but it's
never dissipated. That's my point. I mean, maybe somebody can clear this up to me. It's never dissipated because if the viscosity is very small, it goes down to smaller and smaller scales, searching for that scale at which the viscosity will start dissipating, but it never finds it if it's small.
Don't you have a finite time singularity if you do that?
A finite time singularity, this is wonderful. Can you explain that to me?
Well, it's just that if you set this to zero, you have a finite time singularity, so you get a discontinuous solution in a finite time, which tells you that you do reach the discontinuity, however small it is, in a finite time. And the finite time, I mean, the time
equations, the 2D, the 2G, the...
Well, I'm thinking of a 3D system, so I don't
in
know...
In the 2D system, it's been proven that there's no finite time singularity. In the 3D, it's never been proven that there are.
I mean, I think, were you involved also, Richard, in those long email correspondence with David and
yes,
was indicating on?
I mean, we showed that there was zero dissipation
in
the limit as mu tends to zero.
Yes.
But everyone, we had a hard, very hard time discussing that with other people.
Yeah.
The idea is very entrenched.
Yes, it's very entrenched.
And it seemed to be that this it depends on how you set up the problem, whether you're thinking about mu going to zero at a fixed time, or
you just say it like it's an obvious fact. You don't have to talk about which limit is.
No, it's a bit more delicate than that.
I think so. Okay, I guess that's enough. Anyway, I think these guys are loosely discussing things.
Right. I mean, they're trying to throw out some similarities.
This is not a key point in the paper, actually, because they use viscosity.
Right. They define a dissipation operator as a run dissipation.
This is one sentence in the paper, actually, where they say that.
I think it's important as to whether they're careful about their work or not.
Of course, yeah. You're completely
okay.
Yes. So, all right. So, let's talk about the dissipation operator and how they set up the model and all that. So, models. So first, this dissipation operator, they just choose, you can set it to whatever, they go out of their way to, again, define things that they don't use, like the potential for hyperviscosity, and then they just pick N equals 1, but that's how they define the dissipation, and they use N equals 1 from now on.
Isn't it N equals
2? No. Mm-hmm.
4, the base 4.
Was it 2? Maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, N equals 2.
Yeah, N equals
2
they set, and it's 2N.
Oh, yes.
So
yeah, you're right.
So fourth order, just
you're
like
right.
The lowest hyperviscosity.
Right. Very well. They don't do any kind of comparing of different, but they know that other people have, and it doesn't change. The thing that I thought was interesting about this is that it's 2D, actually, this operator. And so for the QG case, that might have some interesting implications. They suggest that, what do they say exactly, that changing the dissipation operator from horizontal to isotropic has a modest effect on the spectrum and shape, but causes no qualitative changes in the Eulerian evolution. So that's kind of a vague statement, but
I think the important point is also that they say that in the third dimension, they assume there's absolutely no diffusion in the vertical.
That's what they use.
And then I think this can have some implications for the results.
They have
no vertical mixing.
But that's right. In the baryoclinic problem in the Earth's atmosphere, the primary mixing mechanism is things from the surface are taken up all the way up to the troposphere. If you look at the formation of a mid-latitude cyclone, you've got parcels of air going from the surface of the ocean all the way up to the troposphere. And the big mixing that's going on is in the vertical, right straight through those beta surfaces. So to ignore the vertical component in a QG model doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think they glossed over that fact and
suggested
it's not a big deal.
The vertical velocity does not appear. here explicitly.
Right.
Which is not to say that there isn't any vertical velocity. You just take the omega equation and you can solve for the hidden vertical velocity, and it acts like that. It does Lagrangian invection. So to say that because a vertical velocity doesn't appear explicitly in the equation, but is solved using a second requirement, is, I don't think it makes any sense at all. If you're going to do Lagrangian mixing, you have to put it in vertical velocity. The fact that you need a diagnostic equation to solve for it isn't a physical issue.
Right. Well, but go ahead.
I'd just like to ask a nice question. This statement that you can use hyperviscosity with the end you want, I mean, doesn't make any difference. It's a bit weird to me. Because I have the impression that if I take n goes to infinity, then I suspect that you should have absolutely no dissipation in the system. So you should react to a statistical equilibrium, and then the energy spectrum goes by k to the 2 or something like that. So that's also an experiment you can do numerically. If you say hypothesis is n very, very large, then viscosity is a step function in Fourier space, and then you just pile up energy. So how comes that they say that having whatever n doesn't change anything to the system except in the dissipation one? To me, it's wrong. You can choose, if you choose n equal 20, I guarantee that you will get a different spectrum.
But I think the key point in this paper here, they simply use this hyperviscosity to regularize the solution.
Yeah.
They this is the only thing they use it for. They do not really.
Right, but to me it's not obvious that it doesn't do anything to the system at scales larger than the.
Sure,
that's another loose. They speak loose.
It's a loose.
Right. But at least for me, at least that one.
Yeah. The other side things I'm wondering in this community, I mean, how does it work? Do everybody agree that hyperviscosity does nothing? Or
right.
Properly chosen based on careful contrivance. Really, what they're doing here is they're saying we all know what we're talking about. So we can speak.
Right. I mean, I think that part of it is a separate discussion. I think what is more disconcerting is this issue of the 2D operator versus 3D operator, like you're saying. And I think they're just trying to make it, make the two equations most similar and strictly be different in the vorticity, having this stretch out here. So, all right. So, yes. All right. So, so then they solve these equations, and the way they do it, so the QG. Initialization is, so what they do is they initialize the QG, run it, and then take a slice out of the QG model and initialize the 2D model with that. So a slice of the vorticity, I believe. So the initialization for the QG is zero mean Gaussian vorticity. And it's freely decaying, so they're not forcing it. And then to compare the two, they do three realizations of the 2D version. And then three horizontal slices from the QG. All right.
Just because this is the crux of the paper, I think it really has to be looked at carefully. They've assumed a conclusion here without ever bothering to say anything about their motivation. Everything they do from now on is based on the assumption they make here without comment, which is to choose a initial spectrum for these things that is, geophysically speaking, weird. What this thing is peaked at wave number 22. Now look, geophysical spectra are red. What do you typically get? Like supposing you've got convection or something like that. It's essentially a delta function with a slight fault. So what it has is it's red. It has sort of a constant for large wave numbers, and then it sort of falls off for small wave numbers. What these guys are doing is going way out here at 22 and sticking up a great big peak. This is weird. It has one major consequence. What it does is this Fourier transform, this two-dimensional circle, is a Bessel function. So what this does is it produces vortices. It produces a whole sea of totally unphysical vortices. Now, it's got nothing to do with what would normally happen if you took a normal spectrum that you would see. This is manufactured by taking this very peculiar peak spectrum. They chose it to make vortices. Anywhere you read their paper, nowhere do they say, in order to make a whole lot of vortices, we chose this weird unphysical spectrum. They just sort of like pass over it real quick. But everything that goes on in the paper is talking about the results of having this sea of vortices. I mean, why would you do that? I mean, why would you not at least comment, at least say something like, we wrote this paper to show what would happen if you have a whole bunch of unphysical vortices, which is what they should have said.
What do you think a referee would have said?
What
do you think a referee would have said?
Well, why didn't they use, you know, a red spectrum, a normal spectrum? You know, why did they choose that?
Right, right. Start from a different.
What cruel game were they playing? What were they trying to do? What were they trying to accomplish by doing something so strange?
I think they have done, previous to this, this group did a lot of work on pure 2D turbulence and Lagrangian spreading 2D turbulence with somewhat similar emission conditions. So it was vortex dominated. And the issue there was to demonstrate that the vortices really introduced an anomalous diffusion. So it would not really diffuse the mean square displacement, which could not go like T to the power 1, but T to the power 1.5 or something like that. So that is their starting point. And then they want to test if this also carries over in this quasi QG case, which of course I think from their setup with no vertical mixing, it's clear from the start that it will do, and that is also what they find.
Because that's the major difference.
Yes, that's what they find also. So.
I mean, I think they also, one of the main conclusions was pointing out we'll get there, the difference in filament structure in the QG versus the 2D, and I think that part of it is geophysically relevant, especially in the ocean.
Yes, the ocean has a lot of vortices, it's true.
But
to say, we're going to choose a spectrum which will give us a lot of vortices, just like we see in the ocean, you know, there would be some, maybe you could understand. But then that would raise the question, why is the ocean full of vortices like this? You know, it's an odd business. Maybe that's what they're doing, but they don't say much about it.
We discussed that last week.
We never figured that out.
It's also a little bit interesting that they, you know, it would be interesting to see if they initialized the 2D simulation the same way and how the vortices developed, rather than start the 2D simulation from the fifth, you know, time, whatever, well, time equals five or something like that.
So, okay, that's my comment. All the results from now on are going to be...
There's that caveat, and this caveat, and yeah.
So Brian, so if the initial condition was red noise, are you saying
we don't get vortices? No. There'd be a large scale field that would get larger and larger.
Do you think that would dramatically change how similar and different?
Yeah, it would be the same conclusion.
Yeah.
This is results for a sea of vortices.
Well, we see that in some sense in the ocean, so that
it's
helpful
the ocean,
for me.
So I mean, yeah, it's true.
Right. All right. So, back over here. So then they talk a little bit about some of the Eulerian characteristics. So for example, faster decay of vortex number in QG but the big one, like I just said, is more filaments. And they chalk this up to the interactions between the vortices in QG being more inelastic. So I guess the vortices in QG are interacting with each other. So more vortex. And also that the filaments that are produced in 2D, 2D filaments are stretched and dissipated more. And they also mention that this is a result of the background shear induced by the vortex interaction, and that ends up being stronger in the 2D case.
Yeah, this argument doesn't make sense to me at all. Because in QG, you have, as you increase the stratification, your Green's function contracts, gets smaller and smaller.
Right.
So let's go to the limit. You know, if we increase it, have a very small Rossby race, we'll end up with a vortex which doesn't have any far field.
Okay.
So how can it interact at all? So to make an argument that QG vortices interact with each other more because they have a shorter range of interaction is, well, naively interpreted, it doesn't make any sense. Maybe there's a subtle reason. Anybody else got the subtle reason? I mean, they treat it like it's obvious. They don't have to even comment on it. Everybody knows that the shorter the range of interaction, the more interaction. I mean, that's how the paper reads.
Right.
There's also an issue about the stability of filaments. Filaments are stabilized by adverse shear in 2D, but that shear is weaker in 3D, so you would, in some, you might expect filaments to destabilize more
to destroy
in 3D
themselves
than in 2D, which is counter to what they're saying here. That's a separate issue.
So this seemed to be a major conclusion in this paper.
Right, and that
I don't know why they didn't discuss the fundamental reason for it or make it.
I mean, they said that in the QG, right, you have a bunch of these tight vortices of whatever sign, and in between them, because their interaction is small, if you do get a filament, the vortices interacting with the filaments in between, I guess, is not going to tear them apart. That's the sort of what I inferred from what they said, and that was, you're right, it's somewhat vague, and
I don't think they helped us with reasoning here.
I'm going to just draw some filaments in various ways, and then the 2D. And more just vortices, not so many filaments. All right. My art will improve as the talk goes on.
On the left, is it meant to be a horizontal plane?
In both. It's a horizontal. Yes.
I mean, in the QG, you've also got vertical.
Yes. No, I know. Right. But to compare the two, you got to look at horizontal plane. So this is figure three, effectively. All right, so then they get into some of the Lagrangian properties with these, which I actually didn't mention here. They inject these Lagrangian particles and watch them move around, and watch them separate from each other and move from their initial positions, and so that you find absolute and relative dispersion. So absolute dispersion, which is basically the mean of the particle's distance from its initial position. Squared, probably, yeah. And then the relative is the distance between two particles at some later time. So it's a function of the time since the initial time. X1 and X2 are two different particles. And then, what does that look like? Right. So, so this is that time tau. Initially, it's in this, what they call the ballistic range, or regime, and then goes in the direction, well, they also, so they discuss a couple of different theoretical results you can get from here. So the ballistic regime where the absolute dispersion scales like tau squared, and then they mostly focus on what they call the intermediate regime, where it scales like tau to the 5/4. And this is the absolute dispersion line. They also have the relative. Something vaguely like this, which after, in what they call their intermediate time regime, goes like tau cubed. This line is the relative dispersion. Squared, sorry, for both of these. And these are log scales on both of these axes. So a squared or r squared. And if you go far enough out, the absolute dispersion would look Brownian. And they note that is not really observed in mesoscale ocean flows. And they say that it's because the large spatial scale and temporal inhomogeneities. It's not clear.
Taylor's classical result is you go from ballistic to Brownian, sort of.
Right.
If you see a smoke plume come out of the smokestack, it starts out growing as T.
Right.
And then it grows as root T afterwards. You know, that
right.
That seems to be what you expected. Most people, but like Taylor, don't talk much about the transition between them. They say, look at the smoke. First it starts going like that, then it goes like that. They don't like focus on this little transition phase where it goes from the T squared to the T in the variance variable. So these guys are like really interested.
Right.
And they claim that in the whole ocean, you never get into another T-square regime is just the result of random motion. This is Einstein's Brownian motion paper in the turn of the last century. It just showed that if you have anything that produces random motions, it will lead to diffusive behavior, which is that. So the natural assumption of anybody, I think, is that if you've got this random sea of vortices that are randomly producing velocity fields, you should pretty quickly see mixing, which is diffusion.
Right.
So I think it's entirely too little discussion about why the whole of the ocean, according to the claim here, doesn't have the obvious mixing behavior that the person might expect and sees in the atmosphere and other places.
But I mean, they have actually written quite a number of papers on particularly this intermediate class, intermediate field. There's a review, an annual review of fluid mechanics by Provenzal, where they go through these things, mostly for purely 2D fields.
Showing that it never happens, or it doesn't?
No, showing that I mean, in 2D turbulence, it is, I think it's very delicate to get these Brownian limit or diffusion limit, because this really sort of tells you that you must have complete random motion, so you must have killed all correlations, basically. And and as long as vortices are dominating, you do not reach this fate, I think.
Okay. I think
at least you need a very, very big.
It's related to the question: what sets the size of the vortices in the simulations?
Yeah.
When the separation is larger than this typical size, then you should get Brownian motion.
Yeah, but you, I mean, you if you have vortex dominance in the turbulence, then you can sort of parameterize your flow in two regimes: the regime where vorticity dominates and the regime where strain dominates. And in the vorticity dominated regime, particles are just trapped in the vortices, they're just following the vortices. In the strain dominated regime, of course, you have, depending on how the strain is organized, you have a strong separation of particles.
Okay, so if you're inside a vortex, you're not mixing at all.
You're mixing because you have, I mean, the vortex have differential rotation.
So you're just ballistically.
So you're
saying that if you're outside the vortex, you don't really have random motions.
There you can have more. I mean, but then you have to sample over a lot of vortices, let's say, to have this random motion. If you have only a few vortices, then you're not really reach this limit of, which is in some sense the corresponding to the central limit theorem, that if you have a lot of Gaussian processes. So that I think is the problem. And therefore your point on how they initialize the spectrum really also says something on what they get.
Because they got the vortices. Remember, there's a lot of work about having the shear increase the wave numbers and then having diffusion. This was this strain, you know, increased diffusion.
Yes, yes.
That's not this at all, because there's no diffusion.
This is not this at all. And in that case, I mean, the diffusion only increases along the
it increases the wave number, and then the diffusion takes it across.
Yeah. But that's not this thing.
That's not this.
I mean, the one point that I would say that they mention here is that this time scale, if you scale it to the ocean, it's relevant in a few days to a few weeks, which is a little bit short for a large mesoscality. It's, I guess, a few turnover times for a smaller surface eddy, but that's not really relevant for QG. So, but you can think of that as being the development of these larger mesoscales, so the unstable, becoming unstable regime. And maybe that's part of what they're trying to get after. All right. Let me say all these things. Oops. All right, so then the last thing they do is they talk about finite time. Ooh, the Abhinav. Exponents. And the idea is that the initial separation distance, some delta x, xt, goes like some exponential. The final separation distance, some exponential multiplied by the initial. So, larger lambda implies more strings. So, that's the idea. Okay, then basically the comparison here is that the Lyapunov exponents look similar, at least in the early to intermediate times between the two simulations. So the early time, and I'm not even going to draw, at least for these first few. So this is like t equals 6, and this is, let's see, slightly off center. So here's 0, here's 2, 4, this is lambda, and this is just a PDF. This is maybe, here's a half. And as the time goes on, you get more nearly zero Lyapunov exponents. So, and the big difference is in later times, I was supposed to get skinnier, but in any case, the 2D simulation diverges a little bit to have basically more vortices. That's their explanation for this, is that there's more vortices at later times in the 2D simulation, and so you'd be thinking you get more strain, and so your particle separation basically gets bigger.
But it didn't look any different on this figure.
It's very, very hard to see. But in the tallest one, they discuss that the, right. Well, they also say they're nearly the same.
Why don't we discuss, rather than try to discuss that, why don't we discuss why this evolution takes place as time goes on? I mean, these finite time.
Why the strain is.
Yeah, the finite time Lyapunov is the rate at which the particles are dispersed. Sometimes they're coming together, everything to the left is zero, right, or they're small. Sometimes they're going apart.
Right.
They're only going apart a little bit more than they're coming together,
right,
but enough to cause the average distance to increase, even though half of them are, 40% of them are. But why does it do this? It looks like in the limit t goes to, we're going to have a delta function here. This looks like a classical progression toward a delta function. You know, you can do it with a Gaussian, you can do it with a square,
right,
you can do it with anything. This looks like a so my guess is that they keep going, this is going to go to a delta slightly to the right of zero. Why is this? I'm not claiming that's going to happen. I'm simply saying if you look at this, it cries out for an explanation for why this thing's doing this.
I mean, isn't that exactly what the dissipation is doing over some time? You're getting the strain, you're taking these terms to these areas where you have very large strain, and that's where your dissipation is kicking in. And it's a spin down problem, right? So you're starting out with whatever your, you know, this sort of strange spectrum of vorticity, and then
by your argument, what it's saying is there's only one derivative of velocity that, because the derivative of velocity is what's on average producing this, right? So you're saying that they're all going to a very small value without much dispersion. Is it the derivative? So the velocity is the dispersion. What's controlling this? I guess that's what, I don't know the answer. What's controlling this? Why is this behavior?
I think I have a little bit difficulties in understanding this. They name it as local
finite
time. And what one usually do, what they have done also earlier, is if they take so-called Weiss field. Weiss field is measuring the strain.
Can we use Weiss field? That's a discussion.
Yeah, right.
Sorry to take over.
No.
But the Weiss field is usually defined as what is that, this rate of strain minus omega. So you can, this is a sort of diagnostic field you can put into the flow. And if you do a perturbation of, you look at a particle and let it move delta R, if you do a perturbation, then you find that delta R actually is written as E2 minus E2 square root of or plus, in one direction, plus minus.
Because they're equal for shear, and for shear the growth is
yes,
linear, so it's
yeah.
Zero.
For so yeah. in the case of the shear separating, then they are separating strongly in one direction, but in the other direction, not really. Of course they have to do it, uh-huh. Be incompressible. But in the case of vortex dominance, this is negative, so they're just
going around in relation.
Yeah. And then this here, W, is related to this lambda, I guess. Or the square root of W is related to lambda, I guess.
So what's going to zero here? W, omegas, what's going to zero?
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know.
Well, I think that's the argument, is that the number of vortices is being reduced. At least in the QG, more so in the QG simulation than the 2D simulation.
Yeah.
And so your omega term there is getting smaller.
If you went down to the limit where you only had one big vortex, you wouldn't have any, the exponent would be just zero. Because the growth would be linear, so the exponent wouldn't be exponential. There would be a separation
right.
If you had one vortex left. But the separation would be linear in time, so this lambda would be zero.
Yeah.
This is the exponential
rate.
That would be some zero exponential. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. So it's actually going, it's incorrect to say it was going to a lambda finite and fixed. It's actually going to a delta around zero, which is
yes.
The final result of one great big vortex, not without any separation, but with linear in time separation. It wouldn't show up there.
Right.
No mixing. No chaotic mixing. Yeah, I think having the two endpoints, I can sort of use the mean value to go between them. Okay.
And the thing is, you can't have just one vortex. It has to come in pairs.
You have to come in pairs.
Oh, you have to have zero finites.
But
still, that's not chaotic. They go
no,
in
but the, so, but still, can it go to zero if you have a pair?
Yes, it's the chaos, I think, that produces the exponential mixing. I think the only, I'm saying more than I know. I know that with one vortex you wouldn't.
Oh, yeah.
With two, you're in this very simple velocity field where the two vortices are doing something. And that may not be complex enough to produce.
I think it would be a positive and negative vortex. So they would sort of keep their distance. In
they would go like this, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a very simple velocity.
Strain.
It's a very simple, it may not have any. But time, you have to say that time-dependent velocity fields produce Lagrangian mixing even when the Eulerian field is limited. So you have to be a little careful.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Yeah, it's not so easy.
Right. All right. And that is basically the end. So perhaps they oversold the similarities and differences. I would like to make a comment on the filament discussion, the differences between the QG and 2D, in particular the ocean. It's a huge feature of the ocean, is that you get these small filaments. It's particularly intensified near the surface, and very relevant for sub-mesoscale dynamics. Maybe in the interior of the ocean, this is something that maybe you could think about and apply. And I don't know, maybe other places as well. But we've already identified several issues, several potential issues.
I mean, this business of stripping off vorticity from vortices is, you know, it's a whole study that's been going on for a long time. So I guess we expect that if we have a bunch of vortices, that we'll see this stripping going on. There's a long history of studying this problem with contour dynamics and patching, and you know, so you need contour dynamics and you gotta somehow clip off these stretched out things. So it may not be completely understood, but I think it's expected from numerous kind of. When you have vortices, you're going to have this cannibalization of one by the other, which doesn't have to strip all the way, but doesn't have to, doesn't have a deformation, doesn't have a deformation strong enough to tear a vortex apart, it can still strip off some of its vorticity. Once it does that, it's going to bring it out into these long contours.
And right.
So this nibbling away of vortices by each other is going to naturally leave this background of you know, crumbs on the table, which is sort of this thing.
Yeah. Any other comments, questions?
Maybe one point you mentioned that they also refer to observations, but as far as I have understood, these observations are mainly in the ocean, mainly from surface-based floats, and then so they only actually see the surface dispersion of the floats, or do they also account for?
Well, so it depends on what observations you're looking at.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So you know, a lot of the things that people infer from sea surface height, for example, that's pretty coarse. And so that kind of dynamics is really relevant for extending pretty deeply beyond the picnic line.
Yeah.
And that would be much more relevant for, you know, features that could be captured by QG. Things in the mixed layer, I think, are pretty well beyond this, you know, Rossby number one or order one. Yeah, it depends on what observations you're looking at. And a lot of them are very, you know, very coarse. So that's to your advantage if you're looking for those deeper, taller features.
But I believe that where they found this sort of strange experiment, tau to 5/4, this is for surface floating buoys, as far as I remember.
Well, I mean, like I said before, that time scale, the order days to weeks,
yeah,
is pretty short for mesoscale eddies.
Yes.
It's right about right for a mixed layer eddy, but again, that's not really well governed by QG.
So how could this model be improved, you think, to account for the vertical mixing also? Is there some easy cure?
Right. I think the idea was to, you know, be able to use things that people have learned from interaction vortices in 2D to extrapolate that to flows that are more relevant in QG. Like Brian pointed out, the dissipation operator being only 2D is really a big issue. I don't know how to take something in 2D and take that into account.
I think though that once they got done developing and being forced, and they go into a balanced state. The vertical velocity has produced the deformation of the surfaces, and now they're in balance. So the vertical velocity doesn't have to continue. I mean, my example is an example of psychogenesis, where you're actually developing the structure. In order to develop a structure, you actually have to produce a vertical velocity to concentrate the vorticity. But once you've accomplished that, you've got a balanced structure, which is sort of what they're looking at. Then the omegas, the vertical velocity, will be pretty darn small. So they may be justified. They didn't discuss it, but yeah, they may be justified in that, because they're thinking of this. They aren't thinking, you see, it's in barycline turbulence. You've got an awful lot of generation going on associated with strong vertical motions. Whereas here, the generation is all over long ago, and they're talking about the passive advection of these already generated structures. And so they're just carrying around a deformed density surface, right, not actually producing vertical velocity.
Right. So which is why, again, going back to the initial state, that's a little bit contrived, right? That they chose an initial state that would produce these vortices coming to a balanced state where the vortex stretching term is no longer that relevant.
These things are not discussed, but
right. And maybe if you came up with a simple background state that was balanced in that way and sort of redid the asymptotics on QG, you would find that vortex stretching term was
small in this mature regime, mature vortex. That's probably what's going on.
But maybe then they should have done a better job justifying that seemingly arbitrary, or not arbitrary, but targeted choice of initial condition.
Do you know if there's some follow-up of this work? I mean,
I don't know that. I know there were a couple more papers by a similar set of authors on that short. I think it was sort of similar topic, but I'm not sure how directly it followed from this. All right.
Thank you.